And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we begin, though, I want to let you know about a unique ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Googling God, and in it you'll find truth-filled answers to the top five questions people ask online about God. Googling God outlines core apologetic responses to life's deepest questions, helping you know why you believe what you believe. More importantly, it will prepare you to respond with confidence and grace to questions and objections that come your way as you live and speak for Christ. Download your free copy of Googling God today by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
Understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. This episode was recorded back in March at a live event held at Holy Trinity Church, Aylesbury, in partnership with Aylesbury Youth for Christ. I was speaking to the Reverend Dr. Joe Boot, founder and president of the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity and author of numerous books, including A Time to Search and How Then Shall We Answer? Joe's spoken all over the world, from Eton College here in the UK to Foreman University in Lahore, Pakistan. Joe, we've had quite a few questions in about the resurrection. Obviously, Easter, at the time of recording, Easter is coming up. One of the questions is, how would you defend the resurrection? One is there any proof that Jesus really did rise from the dead? I'm aware we did a debate about it earlier today, which you can see on the 12th of April. I think it's going to be on Premier Unbelievable, so check that out. But short of that, could you just give us the kind of one-minute TikTok version with a little dance, ideally?
Yeah, really quickly. First of all, it's important to note as a Christian that although as a Christian apologist, I will talk about evidences for the resurrection, the Bible doesn't try and offer a series of historical proofs for it. It declares the resurrection. The resurrection of Christ is the proof. You don't prove the proof, otherwise it wouldn't be the proof. And if the resurrection depends on my proofs, then we've got a real serious problem with Christianity, because then God depends on me. So I would never claim such a thing. So evidences are attention grabbers. They get people reflecting on the claims of Christ. And of course, what we talked about today, as we look at the five core historical witnesses to the resurrection, the ancient texts that witness to the reality of the resurrection, the four Gospels, the Apostle Paul, fundamentally. We have the burial of Jesus in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. We have the empty tomb of Jesus. We have the resurrection appearances of Jesus. And we have the faith, the transformative faith of the disciples, that Jesus has been raised to life again, and declaring that in Jerusalem, the very place where Jesus had been crucified. I don't believe these are legends, because of the early date of these gospel writers. So we have very good historical evidences. Lots of books. You can read umpteen books. N.T. Wright, Bishop Wright at Oxford University, has written an 800-page book on this subject. So this is not something that can just be dismissed and hand-waved away. I do a short summary of the arguments in my book, A Time to Search, which you can pick up on the book table in the lobby there if you want to. So there are evidences. But ultimately, you still have to make a decision, because no historical claim is subject to some kind of mathematical deductive proof. We can talk about the explanatory power. We can talk about plausibility. We can talk about the significance and power of the resurrection, the coherence of it with the biblical world and life view. But historical investigation doesn't demonstrate it, because, you know, can you demonstrate that Caesar crossed the Rubicon? Can you absolutely demonstrate that? Was it Nelson at Waterloo? These are historical things, and we build a case based on sources and evidences. So they're important to get people's attention. But I would defend the resurrection fundamentally in first declaring it and proclaiming it. It's part and parcel of a broader world and life view that hangs together, and the strength and explanatory power of the resurrection is predicated upon the existence of God and the biblical story as a whole.
Excellent. I'm going to ask you, if you can, to squish your answer just a little bit shorter.
Okay, even more. Okay.
Even more, if that's okay.
All right.
This is sort of related, and it's had lots of votes. How would you answer someone with a philosophical presupposition that miracles cannot happen? In a minute.
Well, by simply saying that's a philosophical presupposition. You don't demonstrate or prove that miracles cannot happen. That's just a naturalistic prejudice. At the same time, I guess there's two lines of evidence for miracles. We can talk about the miracles that Jesus performed. You've got the miracles of the disciples. You've got the resurrection itself. You also have God performing miracles today. So I'm a Christian apologist, but I don't diminish or set aside the testimony of those who have experienced healing. I've known people in my own life, close friends. In fact, a young man that I went to, who was older than me, but that I went to seminary with, who was stone deaf in one ear with terrible tinnitus in that ear, healed instantaneously when he was prayed for. And he was being treated at the London Ear Hospital. It doesn't exist anymore, the London Ear Hospital, but remarkable story. So I've known people. I knew somebody in my own church growing up who was healed of Parkinson's disease. All of his shakes and tremors ceased. So that kind of evidence has to be dealt with as well. So just to assert a naturalistic assumption that it's impossible for miracles to happen, you have to put that within the context of a world and life view that person is presupposing. And then the way you deal with it is you do an internal critique of that particular world and life view and whether it can actually account for the intelligibility of human experience.
Good stuff, and that was nice and short. Thank you, Joe. This is a really interesting question. It's something I get asked a lot with my work with young people. Given the likely genetic roots of Christ, do you get frustrated with how Western culture depicts him, and is this problematic? I suppose how my young people would frame it is, isn't Christianity just a white man's religion?
Yeah, well, that's a question born of ignorance, and it's one that we need to dispel, and that is very easily done by explaining that Jesus was a Jew. That most of the early disciples were Jews. They're from the Middle East. The spread of Christianity throughout parts of what we would call the Mediterranean and North Africa, that Christianity was almost certainly in India and China before it reached us. As I said to some students today in assembly, when Christianity came to us through the Romans in the 4th century, and then through the mission of Augustine of Canterbury in 597 AD, we were still drinking the blood of the dead and sacrificing our children to pagan deities. So, it's got nothing to do with being a white man's religion. That is a ludicrous Marxist critique of Christianity out of the 19th century. The center of Christianity today unequivocally is the global south. There are more Christians in the global south today than there are in the northern hemisphere. So the strength of Christianity today is in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in South America, not in Europe. There are more Christians worshiping Christ in China today, about 100 million, in a Marxist culture that suppresses Christianity than there are in all of Europe put together. So that is easily dispelled by actually just dealing with the facts of the case. The most prominent early theologians in the church were African. Well, St. Augustine, who I mentioned earlier, the City of God, is an African bishop from Hippo. So Christianity is emphatically not a white man's religion. It's a global faith that has spread throughout the globe for a season, by the grace of God. Northern Europe and North America was the center, numerically, was the center of Christianity for a period of our history, and we sent more missionaries to other parts of the world than any other nations. That has now shifted, and thanks be to God, it's Africa and Asia that are sending us re-paganizing Westerners missionaries now to recover their delinquent parents in the faith.
So this is sort of harking back to some of the stuff that you were saying about politics. This is a question. How would you respond to Jesus making the distinction between what is God's and what is Caesar's?
Yeah. So, yeah, that was the question of the coin and the denarius. You know, those denarii, they carried very interesting inscription, Pontifex Maximus, Augustus Caesar, worshipful son of God. There was the claim of the Caesar cult was that Caesar was the son of God, and his imprint was on the coins. Now, it's a complex question in terms of an informal fallacy of logic that Jesus is asked there. It's a sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't type of question. You know, is it right that we should pay taxes to Caesar? If he says no, you shouldn't, then he's seditious and he should be arrested. If you say yes, you're a friend of the Roman Empire, not really a friend of Israel. So they were trying to trap him. And so he said, show me a coin. He says, whose image, whose imprint is on this? They said, Caesar, well, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and give to God what belongs to God. Pay your taxes, fine. But give to God what belongs to God. Whose imprint is on you? Whose image is on you? So, and I would say there as well that, you know, what belongs to God for Jesus, remember, he's the one who upholds the fullness of the law, is make sure the tithe is brought to the Lord. So pay your taxes to Caesar, but give you make sure your tithe goes to the Lord where it belongs. So everything belongs to God ultimately, and he delegates certain authorities. He's established, Paul says in Romans 13, the powers that be are ordained of God. That is the structures of authority that God has ordained. They're to be honored. Pay your taxes, but you know, vote for the right people that will reduce the size of the state to the biblical idea of being a ministry of justice, not a ministry of everything else, which is what it's become.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Before we get back to this episode, I just want to take a moment to remind you that this podcast is only possible thanks to the support of listeners like you, which makes your gift today so important. That's why, to thank you for your generous gift today, I'd like you to have a copy of a new ebook from N.T. Wright called What Do We Mean by Heaven? The Resurrection of Jesus and the Rapture. This new ebook offers profound biblical answers to questions about salvation, the resurrection, the afterlife, and the rapture. As you uncover the important answers, you'll also be encouraged and challenged to find peace and hope in the deep mysteries of life. Again, it's our thanks for your gift to help more people live as confident, informed Christians today. To give your gift and download your copy of the N.T. Wright ebook, What Do We Mean by Heaven? The Resurrection of Jesus and the Rapture, simply go to premierinsight.org/unapologetic. That's premierinsight.org/unapologetic. Thank you for your support. Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. How can I be a covert apologist in a school environment? But I suppose we could put that in any environment.
Yeah, as a student or as a teacher? I guess probably as a teacher, maybe, because I'm not seeing all that many students in here. It's increasingly a challenge, of course, in the Western context to do apologetics in the context of the school. Of course, if you are just a student, then you are one among many students. You've got a great opportunity to share your faith. They're not going to kick you out of the school, or they're going to have difficulties throwing you out of the school for sharing your own convictions with fellow students. So, you know, I often find, you know, advise people, look, first of all, 1 Peter 3:15 doesn't say, you know, set apart Christ as Lord in your heart and cram the Bible down the throat of everybody you meet in school. It says, and always be ready to give an answer for those who ask a reason for the hope that's in you. So if you're living the Christian life, people are going to ask why you live the way that you do, why you speak the way that you do, why you act the way you do. That gives you an opportunity. But I would also add that the context for, I believe right now, when we talk about, you know, covert apologetics or whatever, asking questions is always a great strategy. Jesus did this all of the time. If you look at the strategy of Jesus, he spends a great deal of his time asking questions. It opens people up about their own assumptions, causes them to think, forces them to think. That provides an opportunity to engage in meaningful discussion. So rather than sort of in sensitive environments, I always seek to spend less time making grand assertions and actually asking careful questions that gives me then an opportunity to respond.
Yeah, there was a great quote. I think it's Bonhoeffer's that said you should live your life in a way that provokes questions. Gregory Kugel's got a whole book about asking questions, right. And that's really good. I guess related to this, someone's asked, do you have any advice for when to be assertive with apologetics or when to hold back and not push it for the person's benefit?
Well, I think if you're in a group setting, you know, the goal of apologetics is never to humiliate anybody or plume ourselves on our greater understanding. That's just pride and arrogance. So, you know, and that's the opposite of gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience. So I think, you know, especially when others are listening and it's a group, and it's a group context where somebody could be embarrassed or humiliated in some way or put on the spot, that's the time to be sensitive, to hold back. You know, Kierkegaard once said, you know, people can make this admission best on their own, right? Why should we try and force people to make such an admission in front of other people, in front of us? What, so that we can sort of say, yeah, I conquered, I won. You know, the goal is not to defeat people and win arguments, it's to win people to Christ. You know, that's the goal. It's the kingdom of God that we're talking about. It's people's salvation that we're talking about. So I think we should be looking for any strategy that allows people to some degree, to save face, right? And to make those kinds of admissions on their own. Arrange things dialectically, you know, in terms of alternatives, to think this through, reflect on that. That dialectical arrangement allows people to do that. When you're in the one-on-one environment, you've got a great opportunity to be quite a bit more direct and assertive. And then I would say in the other context would be where you are dealing with somebody very vitriolic, where they're coming at it from a very hostile posture. We can be kind and courteous, but nonetheless still, you know, assertive. We shouldn't be doormats. We're not called to be doormats. We do need to be ready to stand up for Christ. And so by being assertive, I don't mean being rude and domineering, but we don't need to be cowed into a mouse's hole because somebody is being, you know, abusive or aggressive or whatever. We can keep a clear conscience, be respectful. So, you know, strategically arrange things. I hope that's not too technical a term. Dialectics is when you're showing people alternatives, and you're encouraging them to reflect on those and think. And if you're clever with it and creative with it, people can see the dilemma they're being presented with without you hammering it home.
And I guess that's where questions help as well.
And that's where the questions.
In all of those situations, Joe, you're assuming that people are interested in this. They're asking you questions. I guess if they're being aggressive towards you, it's perhaps because they really are interested in this stuff, yeah. And they're diametrically opposed. What I encounter a lot is apathy.
Yes.
And that's a totally different thing in some senses, isn't it? How do you respond to people who would say, well, that's true for you, it's not true for me, it's my truth, it's your truth. You go and be your Christian on your top deck of the bus, whatever, just as long as it doesn't sort of impact me because I don't really care. Yeah. How would you respond to that? In a minute.
No, I think there's only so much you can do with apathy. I mean, Jesus even said, you know, it's actually the gospel writers record, Jesus did no miracles in that place because of their unbelief. I'd rather be dealing with a sort of quite vociferous, agitated person who's getting cross, but there is at least some reaction, than somebody who's just hand-wavingly apathetic and doesn't care. I think with the apathetic, it's trying, obviously prayer is important, but it's trying to ask those penetrating questions. Even if they don't admit in the moment that it's significant, you may well make them go away and think and reflect. But, you know, remember, and apologists must always remember, you don't convert anybody. I'm not capable of converting a soul. My goal in apologetics is to glorify God, that every mouth may be stopped, and everyone recognize their accountability before God. It's fundamentally about how we're going to honor and glorify God in this situation so that the Holy Spirit can do his work. You can lead a horse to water, you can't make them drink. So pointed questions and trying to sort of shake people a little bit out of that apathy, but it can't always be done.
I think I've heard it said, I think it might be Gregory Kukor again, an apologist, talks about putting a stone in the shoe.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. This is totally, completely unrelated. How should Christians respond to environmental breakdown and global injustice? Just a tiny little question for you there, Joe.
In 30 seconds. Into global breakdown?
Environmental breakdown. Environmental breakdown. And global injustice.
Yeah. Well, the mandate to care for creation is a biblical mandate. It's right there in the book of Genesis. To worship and to serve, to rule and subdue, to tend and to keep. So there is a conservative and a progressive element to all of that. There's ruling and subduing, there's tending and keeping. So, you know, the goal of human culture technology is generally about trying to make human life, especially in a broken and a fallen world, more tolerable, more bearable. Labor-saving devices, for example, ways to decrease poverty, increase crop yields, all these kinds of things. So there is a Christian and a biblical mandate for caring for creation. It's no coincidence that the humane societies, organizations like the RSPB, the RSPCA, the Humane Society in Toronto and Canada, that a lot of these animal welfare organizations were begun by Christians, many of them by guys like William Wilberforce and his colleagues. So actually, animal welfare was very much a Christian concern. I think to the issue, though, is what is the worldview that undergirds our concern about the environment? And I think to a large extent today, the cause of creation care has been hijacked by a Marxist worldview, and it's become about redistribution. I think in some respects the planet is now seen as the oppressed mass, and human beings are sort of rapacious plunderers of the planet, and a sort of a virus infecting it, and you get the sense that, you know, the best thing you can do for the planet is not have any children, to, you know, trim down your carbon footprint, whereas actually the reality is that the more human beings we have, the more creativity, the more ingenuity, and the better ability we have to cultivate and care for creation. If anything, we're facing now, demographers are saying, a coming demographic winter. You take the welfare states of Europe, who is going to pay the welfare bill? You know, if the goal is, you know, abortion, euthanasia, not having children in the name of saving the planet, who's going to pay for all the elderly? There's no economic model that can have a decreasing working population and increasing welfare. So we have to ask some questions then about the nature of welfare. Where's welfare supposed to come from? Who's responsible for that? Is it actually the state? Does the Bible give the burden of welfare to the state? So I think creation care of the environment comes down to a worldview question. If human beings are reduced to a kind of infestation, we've got a serious problem. That's not the way God portrays human beings. You know that all life is made of carbon, right? And that trees eat it. It's not poison. So, but we've got a narrative there's a narrative that now is pushing itself into sort of every area of life, which is becoming increasingly anti-human. And that's frightening. And there's a reason why Canada, where I lived for 20 years, just recently struck down all its laws against euthanasia, because now we're hearing promises from some politicians that they're going to reintroduce bills on euthanasia for a free vote in Britain. because if you've got an aging population and you don't have the working populations to pay the taxes, what's the cheapest thing to do? Not to care for people, as we should do, in age and infirmity, but to end their lives. That's cheap. So the generation that kills its children will be killed by its children. And this is one of the problems now we're seeing in our society, is that instead of wanting to care for one another, we're coming up with excuses to kill one another, and often now it's in the name of the planet. A lot of what's going on is about transfers of wealth from the poorest countries, once again, who some of whom haven't even had an industrial revolution, to Western countries, so that they have to buy our technology. And I think that that is criminal. You know, Africa has been called the dark continent for a reason, because when you look at it from a satellite in space, you know, there's lights in South Africa, but over much of the continent there isn't, because they haven't been really enabled and allowed to fully develop their natural resources. And so while we're shutting down all of our natural resources, China's building coal-fired plants every week. And Britain, this tiny little island, you know, we think we're saving the world because we've got, you know, 2030, we're going to have only electric cars. I mean, it's almost comical in its... So look at the worldview. Let's care for creation, but let's do it in terms of a biblical world and life view, not an anti-Christian one.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources, and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.